Listener Production. This is Crappy to Happy, and I am your host, Cass Dunn. I'm a clinical and coaching psychologist, a mindfulness meditation teacher, and of course, author of the Crappy to Happy books. In this show, I bring you conversations with interesting, inspiring, intelligent people who are experts in their field and who have something of value to share that will help you feel less crappy and more happy. If you're anything like me, you've probably been struck recently by the number of adult women being diagnosed with ADHD, that is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Many women in the media have spoken publicly about their diagnosis. And you might even have friends like I do who've also shared with you that they've been diagnosed, often after their kids have been diagnosed. So I've been wanting to have somebody on the show to talk about this for ages. And I'm very excited today to bring you a conversation with Candon Phillips. Candon runs a very popular Instagram account called Humanity Hive, which aims to educate people about ADHD. And she works in the area of coaching, education, and training around ADHD. Candon is a licensed counselor in the USA. She's worked extensively in the mental health field, and her work predominantly has been in the area of trauma and more recently, obviously, in ADHD. What drew me to Candon was her lived experience of being an adult woman achieving and performing in the world and, like many women, not realizing that she was dealing with this particular neurodivergence, even despite her professional qualifications. I really hope that you enjoy this conversation with Candon. Candon Phillips, welcome to the Crappy to Happy podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Candon, I love your Instagram page for a start. You have an Instagram account called Humanity Hive and you talk about ADHD and particularly adult ADHD. And I think ADHD in women, we'll get to talking about that in a minute. And as I was saying to you off air, this topic has been high on my list for ages to get somebody onto the show to talk about this because I'm from Australia and it seems that suddenly in Australia, many, many women of a certain age, you know, women in their 30s, 40s, 50s even, are suddenly being diagnosed with ADHD. And some of them are in the media and therefore they have a platform and they're talking about it. But even amongst my own social circles, you know, what I'm seeing happening is number one, a whole lot of women, and I would say myself included, going, have I got ADHD? Does this explain all my problems?
Right.
But on the other hand, people saying, oh, well, this is just obviously a load of bullshit. Like everybody's just jumping on the ADHD bandwagon, which is, you know.
Right.
So, Candon, what is going on? Let's just start with explaining what ADHD is. I think we all associate it with little boys running around the classroom and climbing on the furniture. What are the symptoms? How does it present, particularly in adults, I guess?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think we're seeing that phenomenon, you know, across the world, but also in the United States too, where women, and especially that kind of middle age, and it kind of creeps up all of a sudden getting this diagnosis. And a lot of that has to do with the education around it and the way we thought about it, you know, back, you know, subtracting years, 90s, 80s. And you're right.
When I did my psychology training, right? When I was doing my training.
Yes. And even, you know, towards the later part of those years when I was getting my education, we didn't talk about ADHD this way either. I was way into my career when I was like, that's what ADHD is. Wait, that's what I have? No one taught me that. And I'm like trained. So we typically tend to think of it as a six-year-old little boy. And usually the face of that is white, climbing, hyper, talking, all the things. And once you change the skin color, then we shift from an ADHD diagnosis to an ODD or a behavioral diagnosis. And so even that has connotations that really limit accurate diagnosing. And for girls especially, we weren't even thought to have it. This was really thought of as a boy issue. And I think what we're seeing is over the years, we're learning that with ADHD, girls in particular, we're finding even in starting in like kindergarten, when we start school, we're very aware of the societal expectations. Little girls go to school and we're supposed to be calm, polite, neat, clean, quiet, a helper, good grades, smart. We don't get phone calls to our mommies and daddies. And at five, we're picking up on that and we're starting to mask. Okay, what can I do to be the good little girl who meets all these expectations? Not the messy one, not the one who forgets her homework, not the one who's talking out and climbing things too. That's not what little girls do. And so we start masking incredibly young and we start finding ways to manage it. And then all of a sudden we look up and we're adults going, what's wrong with me? So, and I'll rewind a little bit. So if we're talking about ADHD, they're still studying and learning kind of where it comes from. You know, some there's genetic components, there's some parental components, but not necessarily like you called your kid to have ADHD, more of just learning that the way we can approach children who are already maybe prone to have that genetic component can vary on how it presents or the way it presents. At its core, we're looking at like a neurological thing. It's affecting our nervous system, which is just our brain, and it affects our entire body. And it's not just attention and focus. We all think about it like squirrel. That's kind of how we see it in the media. Oh gosh, there's a distraction. How cute is that? Let me get back to my task. And really what we're looking at is issues with executive function and the front part of our brain. If we're getting scientific here, you know, our prefrontal cortex that we're kind of thinking is like our game control for how we're maneuvering through life. How do we interact with the world? How do we know how to plan? How do we know how to manage our impulses? All those things. And that is one of the big parts that are hit for people with ADHD. We can really struggle with those kind of things. So you'll see the typical like forgetfulness, making really small mistakes, even having trouble remembering the thing we're supposed to remember to do. And while I think those pieces are obvious, what we're seeing more now is really recognizing the emotional hyperarousal and the sensitivity to rejection and things like that, that have a larger impact on how we function in our life than more than just the forgetful pieces, the distractions and things like that. We're really seeing that, well, we struggle with emotion regulation. We've got really intense feelings and that can affect relationships, that can affect jobs, that can affect the way we parent.
That's the kind of thing that I'm really interested to understand better because, you know, now we're seeing other aspects. We live in a world clearly where we are highly distractible. We've had smartphones and technology and we're a million things pulling for our attention all of the time. And a lot has been said about this, not just for adult brains, but kids' brains as well. So that's when we start going, well, hang on a second. Is this just because we're on our phones too much? So, but when you start talking about these other aspects, I guess, that's when I think it's you start to be able to some degree, perhaps to differentiate, or do we?
Right. And so I like to kind of start off when I'm thinking about it with the nervous system. And because we all talk about, like you just said, well, we're all on our phones. We're all kind of addicted to technology. We're all picking things up and we're distracted. We can't focus for more than, you know, however many seconds. But underneath that, even that distractibility, for someone who doesn't have ADHD, you probably still have a pretty neurotypical nervous system, whereas our nervous system is an interest-based nervous system. And that nervous system tends to get us often labeled as lazy, as selfish, as not interested, as tunnel-visioned. And that's because what it is let's say if my husband wakes up and he doesn't have ADHD and he looks at his day, he needs to get himself ready. He needs to eat. He needs to go to the gym. He's got some work appointments, maybe a lunch with a friend, and then he's going to come home and do family stuff. And he can look at that whole day and there are going to be things in there he doesn't want to do, but they just need to get done. And his nervous system goes, great. All of those are important for different reasons. Doesn't matter if you want to do it. We're going to make sure you've got dopamine and the chemicals you need to feel confident, motivated, capable, and to get the job done. Have a great day. And then I wake up with my interest-based nervous system and I'm looking at my day going, I need to get clean. I need to get the kid to school. I need to do work. Maybe I've got a friend thing later, come home, clean, cook, whatever. And my nervous system goes, yeah, none of that's new or exciting or interesting. Maybe that lunch with a friend sounds cool. You're going to get a little bit of dopamine for that, but best of luck on everything else. And so what it looks like to the outside world is, unless it's something we're really geared up to do, it's like pulling us through the mud to get it done. Well, if you want to do it, then it's no problem. But if I'm asking you to do something that you don't want to do, it's like pulling teeth because you don't care. You're lazy. And we're going, I really want to do that thing too. I know I need to do that thing. I can't get myself out of the mud to do it. I can't figure out what's wrong either. That's the difference in like this attention span and choosing to do things, lazy versus, you know, distracted. I think when we really kind of break it down to that nervous system and how it functions across the board.
I've never heard that expression before, interest-based nervous system. I have heard reference to the role of dopamine, and I was going to ask you about that. So that's essentially what you're saying, that something for the ADHD brain requires like a bigger hit of dopamine to be motivated towards doing something. Is that what is sort of going on?
Essentially, we're known to be dopamine vulnerable, and ADHDers aren't the only ones that can be dopamine vulnerable. Think about people who have chronic depression, you know, dysthymia, that sort of stuff. We just don't seem to regulate, and they're kind of really tweaking the way they're describing it as they do more research, whether it's we don't have enough of it or we don't regulate it well. But essentially, it's our brain, our nervous system isn't regulating and giving us that dopamine and that nice flow that others get. We can generally flow a little lower than everybody else. So we're already kind of not functioning at that level that my neurotypical husband has. And then in moments where we do get really geared up over something, think about that hyper-focus, we're excited, I'm off to find a new hobby type thing, and we're all excited about it, we can get a rush of dopamine. And so all of a sudden now, like, we've kind of blocked the world out and we're locked in, and I'm about to do this really cool thing for hours and hours and hours because I'm riding that dopamine high. Oftentimes I think about parents who are like, gosh, pulling my kid off of playing the gaming system or the phone, or if they're a reader, whatever it is, I always get this big emotional reaction when I'm telling them it's time to stop doing the thing that they're like locked in on. And the way I kind of explain it to a parent is going, you don't have a bratty kid. And if you're an adult doing this, you're not a terrible adult either. You've been on this dopamine train and all of a sudden you've got a big hit. And normally you've got really low levels. And when we have that big hit of dopamine, all of a sudden we're clear-headed, we're sharp, things start making sense, we feel good and confident. And then you're pulling us off of it. And just like that, we go from really, really high to what goes up must come down, really, really low. And that kind of internal switch, you're going to have an emotional reaction. And especially with kids whose brains are developing and the impulses to manage emotions aren't there already, yeah, I bet you did get a pretty nasty response when all of a sudden you pulled them off of that thing. And that shows up as adults too. We're building up to the holiday season, days full of dopamine. When the holidays are over, we're probably going to crash, and then we're going to feel kind of down and be confused as to why.
Yeah, right.
And it's a struggle because I think once we start tapping into that and we realize that we've got to create some kind of dopamine diet, we can't just take the really big highs with the really big lows. Okay, I need to prepare myself. Yesterday was a really busy day and I got a lot of dopamine off of that, which means today I'm probably going to be lower. I'm going to be struggling more. What can I do to help today be better? Well, I'm going to throw on some 90s rap music and pair it with a task I don't want to do, and we're going to grind it out. That's how I'm going to do it.
I love that. I want to go back to the difference between boys and girls. And you talked about little girls being socially conditioned and that they start masking, another interesting term, masking their ADHD symptoms. Obviously, when we talk about ADHD, it stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but not everyone has the hyperactivity. I think that's where there is some confusion too, right? So instead of just calling it ADD, which a lot of people do just shorthand ADD, they call it ADHD inattentive type. Is that so? Basically, just pull that H out, take out the hyperactivity, and it's really just more of the inattentiveness. And that's what I always understood was potentially more likely to be happening with girls as opposed to boys. Is that true?
It's been thought of that way for a while. And I think what we're actually learning is that most people that have ADHD, whether they're classified as inattentive or hyperactive, still have a hyperactive piece. But when we think about the diagnostic piece of it, when we say ADHD inattentive, what we're actually saying is predominantly inattentive. So really what we're saying is like, where you're experiencing probably the most disruption in how you're functioning is due to your inattentive piece, maybe not so much your hyperactive piece. And really what I found fascinating when I kind of went down the rabbit hole of learning about this is that when we think of hyperactivity, we still think of that little boy who's climbing everything that he's not supposed to be climbing. And we think of it as this outward behavior. And what we're finding is with children, the outward expression of hyperactivity is only 25%. The rest of it is internal. With adults, it's 5% are we showing outside hyperactivity, and the rest is internal. And if we're thinking about internal hyperactivity, hyperarousal internal, we're talking about things that have probably led to us being misdiagnosed for years. I go to the doctor and I'm like, gosh, yeah, you know, I'm having a really hard time sleeping. I cannot get my mind to turn off. Kind of like these racing thoughts. And anytime you go to a clinician or a doctor and you say, my mind won't turn off, racing thoughts, you've got anxiety. Generalized anxiety, you're just worrying too much. Well, hold the phone. I never said all my thoughts were worry thoughts. I'm wondering how birds fly. I'm looking at the random colors in the house. I'm thinking about things I need to do. Like, there are some worry thoughts, but oftentimes it's just going. Everything is connected. Our brains have this superpower of really making connections that a neurotypical brain may not see, but that also means I see this thing and I can think of 30 other things. And I'm just like, I need my brain to be quiet. I just really need to go to sleep. I'm tired. Or, you know, we describe what we would talk about anxiety, and it's like this restlessness. And for me, I always kind of scratch my chest. That's where I tend to feel mine, but some people feel it in their body and their stomachs. And it's like, we would classify that mom who can't sit down at the table because she's always hopping up to do something else. Is that really a mom who's got all these things to do, or can she not really sit still long enough and has to hop up and attend to all of those thoughts in her head? Because if I don't attend to them, I might forget them, I might not do them, and my body feels the need to just go. We might see small signs of hyperactivity and not realize what it is because someone is learning to manage that internal restlessness by fidgeting with something, by twirling that hair, by picking that skin, by bouncing that leg, things that we always tend to think of as just an anxiety thing, but could very well be connected to this internal energy, restlessness, hyperactivity that we're trying to manage so we can stay focused.
I was actually just reading Gabor Mate's book, Scattered Minds, and I realized that he had written a book about ADHD, and he's been diagnosed himself and so have three of his children. He was essentially saying ADD, he calls it ADD, ADD is a diagnosis not of category, but of dimension. And at a certain point on the human continuum, characteristics associated with ADD become intrusive enough to impair a person's functioning. And he goes on to say, if anyone who exhibits any trait of it were to be diagnosed, we might as well put Ritalin in the drinking water and sign up most of the industrialized world for group psychotherapy. In other words, yes, if we all have the little bits and pieces of this. The diagnosis is about how much does it impact your ability to live your life, do the things you need to get done. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So I think that's where those of us who are diagnosed, we get prickly when it's like, oh, everyone's a little ADD. And we're going, nah, dude, this is not what you think this is. Yes, you walked out and forgot your keys once or twice, or you mess up an order or whatever. I can't function throughout my day without strict routines or tricks or, you know, all the things, the amount of energy I put into managing my ADHD so that I can't just do the simple things. It's just insane.
That's why I was interested to get your take on that, because this is why I think people say, oh, well, I get like that. I procrastinate and I'm forgetful and I'm distractible. So the degree to which it impacts your life, and what you're talking about is like an insane degree. I don't mean the word insane. And it's of management that has to go on to just get through.
Right. Right. And I think they're finding, you know, the ADHD brain, even just to do simple tasks, has to work like three times harder. And so I often talk about adults, but when I'm usually educating, I kind of reel it back to like a kid version, because usually adults have learned about their diagnosis because their kids got diagnosed and they're like, wait a minute, that sounded like me. but you know, we think about these kids that come home, and I often hear from parents, especially if they're kids that are masking really well at school. I get no issues at school. She's an angel. Everything goes well. Her grades are good. And I come home and I've got this kid who's like emotionally all over the place, and she's having all these issues, and we're struggling. And why am I getting this version of a kid and they're getting that version of the kid? And I go, okay, well, I want you to think for a second. We've educated on what ADHD and how much that brain has to work. And you've already got a child who's masking really well because she wants to be a good kid. She doesn't want to have a phone call with the parents. She wants to be smart. So her brain and her body is working so hard to sit still and be quiet and still get good grades and make friends. And even if we broke that down to just a simple worksheet, you get a worksheet and it should take about 5 minutes to do. And everyone in class has already kind of started. And you're looking at it and you're going, wait a minute, I can't figure out what number one is. Everyone else is working. okay, I've got to really focus because now I'm aware that everyone's working and I'm aware that the clock is winding down and I should be done by now. Okay, focus, focus, focus. Oh, but that question kind of makes me think of this thing and I go down a rabbit hole over here and I need to come back. I need to come back. And that's all just internal. That's just her mind and the awareness of things around her that she's trying to manage and cut out just so she can do a simple 5-minute tasks. How many 5-minute tasks do we have in a day where that brain is constantly having to not just focus on that task, but kick out thoughts that aren't connected, not pay attention to every little thing around us? Of course, by the end of the day, when they're finally home with their safe person, we're about to breathe and all the emotions and all the things we've been like white knuckling through our day to do, it's about to come out.
I remember when we did learn about ADHD back when I was doing my training, to get a diagnosis, you gave questionnaires to everybody. You know, like somebody at home had to do a questionnaire, somebody at school had to do a questionnaire, like different classes had teachers had to do a questionnaire, because for it to be a diagnosis, it had to be a consistent behavior across a lot of different environments. Is that still the case?
I think it would depend on the clinician you talk to. That would probably give you a very different answer than what I'm going to give you. Yes, we're relying on giving teachers and adults to, like you just said, to tick off the boxes and see if in more than one environment are we seeing this struggle. And for some reason, I mean, I know that kids spend most of their time at school, but even doctors can get stuck in, well, if they're fine at school, then they don't have it. Well, that's not the only environment they're in. When you're saying at least two environments, kids are in a lot of environments and school is a more structured one, which we tend to do well with. So why are we making that the end all be all? I think I realized even more so that that wasn't the most effective thing when I used to work in a school that was for special education students. It was self-contained, big behavior issues. So like a very small school, very clinical in the way we approached it. And I sat down with a teacher and I was like, we need to do this Vanderbilt. The psychiatrist is asking me to do it for this kid. Clearly she has ADHD, but I need your input. And she went down the list and I remember the question specifically. She's like, is she disruptive in class? And she said, no. And she kept going. I said, wait a minute. Why'd you hit no on that? She's like, oh, well, she's not like my other kids. They're behavioral. You know, they're like throwing desks or they're arguing or they're up and down. I was like, right. But what she does struggle with is being able to recognize that she's okay in doing the work that she's doing. And there's a lot of emotion dysregulation there, or she's got other questions and some distractibility. Does that disrupt your flow of teaching and the flow of how your classroom is running? And she went, oh, yeah, it is disruptive. I do have to stop and go address these behaviors. It's like, right, but your brain was only thinking about these behaviors that you're seeing in the boys. And so even when we thought about disruption, I realized we're giving these documents to teachers and we're not training them on what exactly we're looking for here. That was a big light bulb for me going, I don't think this is the most effective way. It can be helpful for the obvious one, I think, but for the masking child and the more quieter representations of it, the internal hyperactivity versus the external representation that some kids show more than others, we're missing. We're missing a lot of kids when we do that.
Just to change tack a little bit, Candon, how did you get your diagnosis? Like, what's your story?
I'm the oldest of different kids. I've got kind of a divorce background, but my closest sibling is 11 years younger than me. So there's a really big spread. So I remember him, he was diagnosed off the bat in elementary school. He was your typical hyper boy. And I was getting ready. I think I was already in college or going to college and was just sharing that I was really struggling to keep up. I had great grades. No one would have ever thought that I had ADHD, but I knew I was starting to realize that, yeah, but I'm spending 5 hours to prepare for this test and they're spending 2. And the minute I get that information on the paper, I could not tell you for the life of me what that test was about. I can't recall the information. I'm struggling with that a little bit. It wasn't until I really even got into studying for my degree and getting into my master's where I was like, oh yeah, this is what I have. This is what it is. And then I don't think I really even tried to start taking stimulant medicine until I was in my late 20s and experimented with that. I'm still kind of finding the right cocktail of what I like. Honestly, I didn't fully understand my diagnosis and the gravity of what ADHD actually is until, gosh, 9 years into being a therapist. And I just happened to stumble across an article about interest-based nervous system and rejection sensitivity. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're mistreating like half of our caseload of kids. They all have ADHD and we have no idea that it's all because of ADHD that we're looking at these behaviors. We're thinking it's 5 other diagnoses. And it was just eye-opening.
I think that's the other thing that leads to confusion too. So oftentimes, I guess when we talk about, like you said, in children, it's the climbing the walls. And statistically, I think people with ADHD tend to be like more underemployed or have difficulty holding down jobs and things like that. But actually, many are performing really well. They're actually doing really well in life. I think that's a real misconception as well, right? So people think you couldn't possibly have ADHD because look at how well you're doing and how successful you're doing and you're acing it and you've got a successful career.
That's problematic for more than just the fact that we're missing the diagnosis and the support, but then you've also got those people who are successful and doing well really shaming themselves because, well, I must really just be lazy or there must be something wrong with me in another way. Because they're telling me it's not that, even though it really feels like that. And I had someone comment on a post, it was just the other day, that she went into the doctor's office and because she was reading a book in the lobby, they dismissed her and said, there's no way because you're able to read a book. What? Like, no one said we were stupid.
Wow.
we're not questioning intelligence. There are many of us that we are resourceful and we're usually pretty adaptive. And that's sometimes you hear the word like a superpower. There are some perks to having ADHD. I don't know that they, for me, outweigh the struggles, but we do have an ability to look at a situation and find an alternative way to solve a problem or in a different approach. The argument, I think, for many is that the way our brain is wired that we're able to do that? Or is it because we live in a world that's neurotypical that we have to find alternative ways to do things for us to be able to function? And so I think those of us that have been successful, we've got degrees, we're working, we're happily married, whatever you could, you know, determine success to be, we have found ways to function in this world so that we can be successful. It's not going to look like a neurotypical person does it, more than likely. We've probably got 15 more systems than you even know about, more alarms and more checklists than God should allow for us to just get out the door. But we have found a way to do it so that we can be successful.
But as you're sort of alluding to, Candon, like that success often comes at a cost emotionally, psychologically. Like, what are the other problems that people tend to face or people tend to experience if they have ADHD and it isn't correctly diagnosed? Like you mentioned before about the feelings of shame and, you know, feeling like a loser.
Yeah. So, you know, likely if they weren't diagnosed, and some even if they were diagnosed, you know, the parents still didn't quite understand what that meant. So you're still hearing, you know, 5 times more negative comments than positive comments a day of why can't you, if you would just, it seems like you're selfish, lazy. So you hear that all the time. And at some point you're going to start internalizing it. But we can struggle with co-occurring issues, especially when we're not treating ADHD, anxiety, depression. Burnout is probably like the big light up header over our heads with all of those kind of things underneath, because we work really, really hard and we tend to have to work harder. And then we kind of do that in bursts and kind of like that dopamine thing that I was talking about. We'll burn ourselves out and like work till 3 a.m. on things to just finally get it all done. And then we can't move or function for however many days afterwards. So that can show up in the pattern of work, where all of a sudden it's like, well, they're inconsistent. Sometimes they can really crank it out and do really well. And then other times, like, I can't get anything out of them because they're desperately trying to meet expectations in the way that they can. And I think one of my earlier posts about ADHD was, you know, kind of making light of women showing up and going, you know, like, I've got anxiety and depression and what I'm doing is not working and the medicine's not helping. And it's like, that's not that. It's actually ADHD is your root source that's like bleeding out and causing anxiety and depression, but we're not touching the root. Now, does that mean everybody who has anxiety and depression has ADHD? No. I always have to give that disclaimer because they'll come out wagging their finger at me. That's not what I'm saying. That tends to happen. You can have those issues that are either alongside ADHD and you've got both, or you can have anxiety and depression because of your ADHD and you feel like a failure because you're not able to struggle and you're worried, I'm going to forget this. So I need to like think about that appointment and think about it and think about it and think about it so I don't forget it. Even though I've written it down, I've lost the thing that I wrote it down on. You know, the list goes on and on. And so, you know, exhaustion, burnout. I mean, you know, we don't tend to think about fatigue when we think about ADHD. We think it's this hyper person running around, but it's more so we're tired and trying really hard to meet everyone's expectations.
hope that you're enjoying this conversation and realizing the benefits of positivity in your own life. If you are enjoying the show, please be sure to like and subscribe so that you get notified when new eps drop, and head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a rating and review. One term you've mentioned a couple of times is hyperfixation. I think that's another thing, and you've sort of touched on what that is, because there's this perception that people with ADHD can't focus on anything, when in fact sometimes they can super focus. Do you want to just describe that just briefly? Yeah.
I think if you follow enough ADHD stuff, inevitably you'll see a meme somewhere that's like asking about, what do you think ADHD should actually be named? Because attention deficit doesn't feel true. And I agree with that. It doesn't feel like I have an attention deficit. It's almost like I am aware of everything, and knowing how to focus and regulate that attention on where it should be is my struggle. Not that I'm not aware of the things that I should be doing. It tends to come from usually things that we're really interested in, new, novel, exciting, which is why you'll often hear that we're a jack of many trades, because we've got 1,000 hobbies that we've started, maybe finished if we're lucky, maybe stopped somewhere in the middle and kept going. But when we get something that's new and exciting, we do get that dopamine hit and we want to learn everything about it. I'm going to tell you the history of this new thing. I've got all the things that should make this go well, this art craft, whatever it is. I may never actually do it, but I have learned and I've like deep dive studied on it. And so we can know a lot of stuff, which is really cool. We can't always justify that knowledge, which I think is why sometimes we can get ourselves small. It's like, well, where did you learn that? Well, I don't know. I deep dove on the internet for 5 hours last night. Like, where's your like scientific backup for that information? So, but yeah, it's more of that kind of that dopamine gets really high and we get focused in on that. And our ability to regulate off of it is what we can struggle with. We can struggle to transition from a focused state to something else. Transitions in general can be tough. Again, because it's a shifting. I'm having to stop this, shift it to something else and activate to something else. And that takes a lot more executive function than sometimes we are gifted with.
Yeah. And the other thing I guess I've seen referred to is that I've got this thing to do that's really important, but it's not very interesting. Therefore, I'm going to go over here and spend 5 hours doing this other thing. Like it's like procrastinating. Like I'm a great one for that too, by the way. But I can find a million other things to do to avoid doing, like that are more interesting to me than the one thing,
right,
that is necessary.
Right. They're more interesting and they're probably less draining for you mentally.
Yes.
And that was the like and piece add on for me. And I was like, oh, am I necessarily more interested in doing my dishes versus writing this paper? No, but that takes way less mental energy for me. So yeah. I'm going to go do that.
For me, that's tinkering in the back end of my website or something, like something techie that I can spend hours and hours doing rather than doing that thing that's actually important for my business.
right. Yeah, I'll throw out some fun videos. I'm probably not going to respond to those emails that I've had flagged for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay, Keenan, I do. I'll sit down like, Keenan, it's the email time. Turn on the music, put away the phone. Emails are what you're doing for the next 5 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. So hyperfixation was one that you mentioned. The other, time blindness. Tell me about time blindness.
So time is fickle for us for a few reasons. We tend to live in the now. So now and not now. And in general, we can be all or nothing people. We have to work really hard to not make everything kind of a black and white all or nothing situation. But for us, time, it feels like everything we're doing now is urgent and important. And if it comes across my table now, I have a hard time recognizing that I could put that off later and it would still get done. I don't have to do everything now. Not everything is urgent. And so when I think about time blindness, we don't do well in like our awareness of how quickly how time goes. You know, we think we've spent 5 minutes in the bathroom and it's 15:20 and oh my gosh, we're late. And for me, you know, I don't know, and this is going to be like an asterisk, I don't know if this is clinically accurate, but I'm learning more about some of our sensory, you know, interception is as one of our senses. We've got 8 senses. Interception's one that everyone has. And it's that awareness of our internal, you know, emotions, hunger, thirst, all that kind of stuff, you know, bathroom urges. And I think I always kind of have a question mark, you know, is awareness for us time related to that too? Like we're not able to judge how long it's taking us to do something. I don't know. But I do know that we often feel like we're in a hurry. And because for us, with time, it's kind of like if we don't do it now, if it doesn't happen now, our brain almost says it will never happen. So we're rushing all the time. We're forgetting things because we're trying to cram too much into one time. And if we're locked into something, especially if we're hyper-focused into something, it's not just time that we get blind to. Like I sometimes won't hear someone trying to get my attention or notice things around me because I am just like tunnel vision locked in. And that means all of my senses are locked in. And so it's, again, part of that executive function piece is being able to take notice of time. And I think that, you know, for me, I can have the misconception and I often think that things are going to take a lot longer than they do. I think I did a video yesterday of like, oh, I need to clean up my son's room of toys. And I had a Hot Pocket in the microwave for 2 minutes and 40 seconds. And I went in there and I literally had his floor cleaned up in 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Whereas my brain was like, that's going to take you 30 minutes to get that done. We don't have a great read on time. And, you know, that can also play into our sleep issues. I think the way I read it being described is kind of like our circadian clock is off a bit. And so, and this kind of pairs with hyperactivity a bit. It's all kind of like strung together in these weird little ways as ADHD is. But it's, you know, even with time and that circadian clock rhythm, you know, everyone else's bodies are starting to wind down as the day gets darker and as we get closer to bedtime. Bodies recognize that as that clock shifts, it should calm us a bit and we should start to slow down and get ready for sleep. Whereas it's almost kind of like come 7 p.m., everyone else is winding down and our bodies are kind of going, no, it's like 3:30 p.m. Here's your other boost of energy to get through the back half of this day. And you're going, oh, for the love of God, I need to sleep. I don't need energy. And so even that, you know, sense of time for us is off and it can affect our sleep cycles really in a big way.
I can see how all of these things, all of these manifestations of ADHD would cause people to just generally feel shit about themselves. Like just feel like they, like you said, internalizing those ideas about I'm just, something's wrong with me and I'm just disorganized and I'm just lazy and I'm just unproductive and I never get the things done or the important things done. What I'm really interested in, Candon, is how widespread trauma is in our society. And it occurs to me that the impact that trauma has on the developing brain and the way that plays out is often very, looks very similar to the way an ADHD brain works. And I mentioned that to a friend of mine just recently. You know, she was talking about, I think one of her kids had a symptoms of ADHD. And I mentioned that to her. I said, if you look at them like a Venn diagram, like the overlaps between trauma manifestations, I guess, and ADHD symptoms, they very much overlap. What's your take on that? I guess not that trauma causes ADHD, or does it? Or how much does it play into the diagnosis of ADHD?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think as clinicians, especially when we're having to diagnose, if someone walks in that's got a significant trauma history, a lot of times people won't even look twice to investigate further into possible ADHD because we assume that it's just the trauma. And it may just be because they can manifest and show up in such similar ways. And I think even the more that we're looking into it, people with ADHD, we tend to have traumatic experiences in our past. And I've had people kind of question, especially on Humanity Hive, like, well, isn't that just because like they had a shitty parent or shitty lifestyle or, you know, upbringing? I'm like, not necessarily. I've had really young children come in with healthy families, nothing's happened, like, and they still have ADHD. And so I don't think it's necessarily always because of it, but I think that that kind of plays into what I said earlier, you know, how, where does it come from? Even just this year, I think some articles came out recognizing that like, there's definitely genetic components. Clearly, you know, you've got a parent has it and their three kids have it. Doesn't mean that everyone's going to, but like, yeah, there's genetics are there. But then they're also finding that parenting or the household they're in does play an effect in either if those symptoms are going to show up and be disruptive or if they're just going to be mild and manageable. And I think that's kind of where we come into the trauma piece. Toxic stress is trauma. If you're living in a household where things are unpredictable, i.e. maybe an undiagnosed parent with ADHD, your environment's not predictable. Their emotions are all over the place because we have really intense emotions. And if we're not managing them well, that's traumatic. You know, why is my parent blowing up at me all of a sudden when I did this exact same thing 2 days ago and it wasn't an issue? It's not a predictable environment. That's traumatic. And people don't think about that. And so I think I often just personally think about, you know, when we're looking at adults who've got ADHD and we're finding traumas in the past, that it's sometimes due to growing up in an undiagnosed ADHD household. And that can just produce a lot of unpredictability and sometimes toxic behavior. So yeah, I think the brain can look very similar for both.
And I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Like you just said, we see a family sort of lineage of ADHD and say, oh, well, there's clearly a genetic component there. And I think clearly there is, but trauma is also intergenerational. You know, traumatized parents will often have traumatized kids. And it's the spectrum as well, right? I think you make the very valid point. And this is the thing that I'm trying to get at a lot on this podcast as well, that all trauma is not that big deal. Trauma, it's for a little child, anything that makes your world feel unpredictable and unsafe, it's the internal reaction that you have to that. That is the trauma response. It's not, doesn't have to be some big, massive.
It can be traumatic for me and not traumatic for you. But then it affects me and my brain differently. So I will have a consequence of that. Yeah, for sure.
In Australia, I mean, I was just following somebody the other day on social media as well. She's a media personality in Australia, and she was having a bit of a rant actually because some influencer had posted on her Instagram story that all these influencers were jumping on the ADHD fad, and she was saying it took her 18 months and thousands of dollars to get a diagnosis in Australia. I don't know what it's like in the US, but what is the process these days? I presume that you need to see a psychiatrist. That's the process in Australia. You actually have to be referred to a psychiatrist to have the assessment done. We can all sort of, as therapists, we can have a provisional diagnosis. We can kind of say we think this is what it is, but it actually requires a medical professional to diagnose and prescribe medication for it. Is it the same where you are?
It's not the same. I'm learning that more and more that there's much more limitations outside of the United States for this. So no, the process, it doesn't have to be by a psychiatrist. Even where I live, it's almost been kind of the reverse. So like, you know, parents will take their kids to, like, say, the pediatrician. They're talking about concerns behaviorally, and the pediatrician, there's a shortage definitely of psychiatrists. So we have a lot of general practitioners prescribing medicine, and they don't always feel comfortable doing that. So they will refer them even to a therapist. So I would get a lot of referrals as a licensed professional therapist. I'm not a doctor, but because this has ended up being what I've specialized in and I've gotten excellent assessment tools that I feel like are trusted, then I'll give the diagnosis and write up, you know, the areas of function that they're struggling with, and which, you know, whether they're inattentive or hyperactive or combined, and send that documentation back, and then all of a sudden they'll get the medicine. So often, I think here in the United States, clinicians are doing a lot of the, therapists are doing a lot of the diagnostics, and then sending those referrals for people to take that to the doctor or even to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, interesting. And you do make a good point. It might be that pediatricians in Australia can diagnose children. I'm not sure about that. Candon, you now also do ADHD coaching. And that is a thing. I'm seeing that a lot online, this ADHD coaching. So I guess my question, probably just to wrap this up, is like, what if you have been diagnosed, if you are thinking, oh my God, this is me, and you do get a diagnosis, like, what are the treatment options? Obviously, there is medication. And then there are services like such as what you provide.
There's a lot of things out there. And again, I think people may find something more beneficial than someone else because we're all individuals. So you may have more trauma than I do and may need something a little bit different. So there's definitely medicine out there. We've heard about those. You know, you have a stimulant medicine and a non-stimulant medicine. There's a lot of supplements, and there's a lot of new kind of science going into nootropics and things like that. And it all depends on the person you ask as to whether they find one beneficial or not. Getting the right nutrients and supplements and eating well and sleeping well are huge because that's what makes our brain function clearly. Then you go into having, you know, you can do therapy approaches with things like cognitive behavioral therapy can be helpful, and really more of just kind of reframing how we think about what we're doing. Kind of like my video yesterday, I'm in this like I can't stage, and I really need to remind myself, no, I can do this. And that kind of helped me get on the train of doing what I need to do that day. I also find that I think there is a lot of benefit in things like occupational therapy when we're thinking, especially for younger children. It's a nervous system issue. And you've got an occupational therapist who's trained in being a sensory therapist, sensory integration. They're addressing all of the nervous system pieces that really help a lot with regulation of emotion, impulses, things like that. So especially when I've got people coming to me, families that don't want their kids to start off with medicine yet, like, you need to go get an OT eval. Those are really helpful because we have such emotional dysregulation, not unsimilar to some personality disorders. Dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, I think is very helpful in managing that emotion dysregulation piece, rejection sensitivity, dysphoria that we can function in. I also like acceptance commitment therapy. Sometimes we have to really come to terms with, this is who I am and this is the way I am. And I can still be okay and I can still work with this, but wishing and hoping I'm going to find the magic thing to make this go away.
Yeah. These are all the things that I love, like everything mindfulness-based, the ACT, DBT. Mm-hmm. I think they're really, really helpful. Actually, before you go, Kenan, I said we were winding this up, but rejection sensitivity dysphoria, that's another term that is one that I've only recently become aware of in the last couple of years. Can you just describe that quickly?
Yes. So it translates, it's a great translation. Basically, rejection is too much for us to bear. And if you talk to people that experience it, and they used to think it was only like 80% of ADHDers, and now they're thinking that pretty much everyone who has ADHD experiences it on some level. Any form of rejection, whether it's real or we perceive it, we think it might happen, can cause significant emotional pain. And some people even describe like a physical pain. It almost feels like if there is a moment or a situation where I feel like I failed, I wasn't perfect, I didn't meet the expectations, you didn't like me, you actually rejected me, I didn't get top marks, I wasn't the best, I had to practice, I wasn't immediately good at it. Whatever you can put in the umbrella of rejection, it can feel like almost a truck is hitting me. Like it is so intense. Some people describe physical pain with it, but we can ruminate on that and get stuck on it, and it can limit us. We can go into extreme avoidance because of that rejection sensitivity. So avoidance could look like pushing people away, even if we love them and care about them, because we're already worried about when they're going to leave us. We're already kind of worried about our mistakes that we're going to make, not going for a job or not starting a new hobby because I might not immediately be good at that, or I might have to practice, and practice means failure and mistakes, and I can't handle mistakes. So I'm going to keep myself small. And for people that experience it, you know, if I'm thinking about how I make decisions and choices and putting myself out on the internet, oh my God, that was huge for me to like even show my face and start talking, because my brain's telling me, you're an imposter, they're going to find out, you're not good at this, you're going to make a mistake, and mistakes aren't allowed. If you make a mistake, then you're canceled and you're done, like the snowball effect. And that can happen over, you know, a little kid wanting to go across the playground and make friends. They're not going to like me. They're going to think I'm stupid. I'm not worthy of having friends. And then you know, times 100 for the adult world. It can be really hard to navigate life when you're struggling with that.
Yeah. Hence more anxiety, depression, diagnosis, and around we go.
And around and around and around. Yeah.
It's so interesting you talking about that, Kenan, because recently in the last couple of years, really shifted the focus of my own work to working with women around self-confidence and particularly overcoming imposter syndrome and cultivating more kind of self-worth and self-belief. And my focus and my approach with that is because everything that I read about imposter syndrome and what to do about it, I think doesn't even touch the surface of dealing with true imposter syndrome. I think people are very good at giving you ways to overcome pretty normal self-doubt, whereas imposter syndrome runs much deeper. And my approach often has to do with, you know, managing your nervous system responses to fear of rejection. We talk about the procrastination, the perfectionism loop that runs. And I'm now thinking that I really need to be incorporating something into my own program about ADHD, because potentially a lot of these women that I'm working with who are experiencing really serious kind of imposter syndrome, really holding themselves back, and it is much, much worse than just standard self-doubt, then potentially there is an ADHD thing going on here. Because we talk about trauma, we talk about the impact that has, the shame, that, you know, how that impacts all of these things that you're talking about. I think for at least some of these women, that's potentially what is going on.
Right. And then, you know, it can even just show up in assuming that, you know, your partner, your friends are always mad at you because they've got not a smiling face. I mean, it's like we can twist the smallest thing and all of a sudden everyone's mad at us and we're failing. That's a lot to manage too. When we're thinking about fatigue, that's just one more thing that we're having to like check and manage and regulate and check for evidence for, just to get through sometimes basic interactions.
Kenan, this has been the most fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making the time. I know everybody is going to love this because everybody's got the same questions and you've done a really great job of answering them for us. So thank you so much for talking to me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. This has been a blast.
To find out more about Candon and her work in ADHD coaching, go to humanityhive.info. Her Instagram account, which is very popular, as I said, is at humanity_hive. Obviously, my Instagram and TikTok at CassDunn_XO. Please come and connect with me there. If you like the show, please do subscribe, leave us a 5-star rating and a nice review. And I cannot wait to catch you in the next episode of Crappy to Happy.
Listener.